Welcome to The Spot, KALW's showcase for the best in public radio podcasts.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. In 1914 in Manhattan, the city government took ownership of an apartment building belonging to a guy named David Hess. They used a legal power called eminent domain, which allows governments to seize private property for public use. In this case, they wanted to expand the subway system. Hess fought them and lost. And when it was all said and done, his building was torn down, and he was left with a triangle-shaped piece of property.
And when Roman says triangle-shaped, he means the property Hess was left with was about the size and shape of a very large slice of pizza. He was not amused.
That's our producer, Katie Mingle.
Later, the city tried to get him to donate his pizza-shaped property so they could build a sidewalk. He refused again. They built the sidewalk anyway, and in the middle of the sidewalk is Hess's triangle with a tile mosaic that reads, "Property of the Hess Estate," which has never been dedicated for public purposes.
In other words, get off my triangle, jerks. It's still there, by the way, on the corner of Christopher Street and 7th Avenue in the West Village.
People like David Hess, who refuse to sell their properties, are called holdouts. And eminent domain only comes into play when the government wants your property for public use. If it's a private development that wants your place and you refuse to sell, there's not much they can do.
Although there have been cases where eminent domain has been controversially used for private development, but that's another story.
In China, they call their holdout houses nail houses. You may have seen some of the pictures of single houses sticking up like the head of a nail, everything else around them bulldozed and carved out.
Basically, anywhere there's a lot of new development, there are bound to be developers who have plans to make lots and lots of money if they could just get that one stubborn person to move.
Which brings us to one of the most stubborn and steadfast holdouts ever, Edith Macefield.
Yes, I always call her Mrs. Macefield.
That's Kathy Milady. She's one of the only reporters who ever got an interview with Mrs. Macefield.
A feat she achieved through unwavering persistence, good manners, and proper attire.
Later, I asked her, I said, "What was it that made you decide to talk to me today?" And she said, "I liked your skirt."
Edith Macefield lived in a Seattle neighborhood called Ballard.
Ballard had once been its own little town until it was annexed into Seattle in 1907, so it had the feel of a small town. A lot of single-family homes and small businesses. That started to change around 2005.
When development really started to sprout, there were condominiums. We started hearing some pushback from old-time residents in the neighborhood who felt that the neighborhood was changing too quickly.
Ballard became so iconic of this type of super-fast, high-density development that
when it happens in other neighborhoods, we call it the Ballardization of my neighborhood.
So in 2005, when Ballard was in the middle of being Ballardized, a developer wanted to build a shopping center that would take up the entire block where Edith Macefield had lived for the last 50 years.
Edith Macefield's house was in a more industrial section of Ballard, and her block was mostly empty besides her tiny house.
Just so you can picture her house. You know, when you're a kid and you draw a picture of a house using a little square with a triangle on top, and then you put a little front door and a couple of windows on each side? That is exactly what Edith Macefield's house looked like.
The developers offered her $750,000 for her house, which was appraised at about $120,000. And as you can probably guess, she said no.
And so they said, "No problem. We'll just build our mall around you." Like, literally, all around you.
Hi, I'm Barry Martin. I work in construction as a project superintendent. So I'm just the guy out there on the site making sure that, you know, it all gets done.
Barry was hired to oversee the shopping center project, and he'd heard that some Ballard residents weren't happy about all the new development, but he wasn't too worried.
I mean, it was just a job for me. You know, I didn't really think about it, you know, really one way or another.
He hadn't yet heard about Edith Macefield.
So when I got closer to where I was going to start the project, my wife asked me if that was the one where there was a little old lady down in Ballard that wouldn't move. I said, "No, that's not it, because, you know, these guys would have told me." I called them up, and they said, "Oh, yeah, didn't we tell you?"
Whoever said you can't stand in the way of progress has never tried to step over Edith Macefield.
The Ballard woman who refused to sell her little house to developers.
The little old lady being bullied by developers.
The story was classic David and Goliath. Edith Macefield versus the big bad developers.
And Barry Martin wasn't super excited about all the extra media attention on his project.
I'm thinking this is a lose-lose proposition because all she has to do is, you know, complain and, you know, tell somebody at the TV station or on the newspaper, or, you know, it'll be a really big deal.
But even though the press was clamoring to talk to Mrs. Macefield, she wanted nothing to do with talking to them. Kathy Mullady had been one of the few exceptions. Here's Mrs. Macefield turning down help from a CBS reporter as she took out some trash in her front yard.
Do you want some help, Edith?
No.
Excuse me? She liked to be addressed as Mrs. Macefield. Thank you very much. Later in the segment, he knocks on her door, and you can hear a muffled, "Go away."
Is there any?
Go away.
Okay.
Unfortunately, that muffled recording of a cranky Mrs. Macefield is the only one we could find of her. She passed away in 2008, which we'll talk about more later.
About my second day there, I went walking by Edith's house, and she was out in the front yard with her flowers and her little dog that was blind.
The workers started to demolish the few other buildings that were on the block and dig up a bunch of soil that was contaminated with lead. And all the while, their neighbor, Mrs. Macefield, went about her business day after day, just like she'd always done.
She'd get up in the morning and feed the birds and throw bird seed out on the sidewalk. Most of the time, the bird seed would be there when we got to work. And if the bird seed wasn't there by 10 o'clock, we knew something wasn't right.
If they didn't see the bird seed, Barry would knock on her door to see if she was okay.
And she would usually yell at me to get the hell out of there and go away and leave her alone. And then I'd just tell her that, you know, okay, I'm just checking on you.
A lot of people thought that once the construction started in earnest, Edith Macefield would fold. The noise and the encroachment on her privacy would just be too much.
The architects even designed the building in such a way that if Mrs. Macefield ever decided to move, they could easily incorporate the space where her house was into the building.
But she didn't fold. The developers upped their offer to $1 million. Plus, they offered to find her a similar home somewhere else and pay for a home health care worker. She turned them down.
A year passed, and the building around Edith Macefield's house got bigger and bigger. The image of it was really something. You may have seen pictures of the house, especially if you're from Seattle.
The building towered 40 feet above her. You know, her little house was dwarfed fairly well.
It wasn't just a big building sitting next to a tiny house. It was a big building completely enveloping a tiny house on three sides. The walls of the building were so close that Mrs. Macefield could practically lean out her window and touch them.
As the building moved forward, the construction workers kept checking in on Mrs. Macefield and occasionally bringing her lunch from McDonald's. She purportedly loved Big and Tasties. And Barry kept dropping off business cards, telling her to call if she needed anything. And then one day, she finally did.
Said that she didn't feel comfortable with driving that day, and could I give her a ride to go get her hair done? You know, we got her in the car and started driving over there, and we were kind of talking about how, you know, Ballard was changing.
And sort of surprisingly, Edith Macefield wasn't angry about the way Ballard was changing. She wasn't even angry about the mall they were building more or less on top of her house.
She said, because it always changes. She said, 20 years from now, they'll be tearing this down and building something else. She said, that's just the way it goes. I felt like she was happy that we were there.
She said she didn't mind the noise. She said, I was through World War II.
That's Kathy Mullady again.
And she didn't mind the attention from those young construction workers who walked by her house and waved to her or smiled or checked in a little bit.
She'd been there for 50 years. At that point in time, you know, she was 86 years old. Money didn't really mean much to her anymore. She couldn't move around very well. She knew where everything was in her house. She had no reason to move. She didn't have any family, so getting the money so that she could leave it for her family didn't exist.
Mrs. Macefield didn't have any living family to leave any money to. And by the same token, she didn't have any family to help take care of her in her old age.
Pretty soon, Barry started taking her to all of her appointments, and then he started making them. And then he got concerned that Mrs. Masefield, who was getting more frail by the day, was going to burn herself on her stove, so...
I just started swinging by there after work and making her dinner. She wouldn't get a microwave, so I guess I have to cook for her so I don't have to worry about it anymore.
Pretty soon, Barry was making her lunch and breakfast as well.
One day I woke up and I'm making her three meals a day. And then I had to come in on Saturday and Sunday because, you know, I had to make her meals.
Spending all this time together, he got to know Mrs. Masefield pretty well. They'd listen to music together, watch old movies, and Mrs. Masefield also had crazy stories about her past.
She told me that she was a spy for the British government, that she had been captured spying, and they put her in Dachau. Then she escaped from there.
She also said she'd taken care of a bunch of war orphans in England after World War II. And on top of all of that, she claimed to know a bunch of famous people.
She told me Benny Goodman was her cousin and that she had met Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey and had played, saxophone and clarinet with them.
Her stories were so incredible that they were hard for people to believe, but they were harder to dismiss than you might think.
She came across to me as very sharp. She liked to talk a lot about the past, but she also watched the news and knew exactly what was going on.
Barry took care of Mrs. Masefield for nearly a year and a half, making all of her meals, visiting with her on weekends and after work. Sometimes she'd call in the middle of the night and tell him she'd had an accident and she needed him.
You know, she had very few wishes. One, she wanted to die in her house, live out her last days in her house. But if I wouldn't have been there, at some point in time, they would have put her in a state-run facility. And there wasn't any reason for that. And then she's going to be unhappy the last days of her life. And for what?
When she was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and began to die, she finally agreed to a home healthcare worker. But Barry became her power of attorney, the person she put in charge of her final decisions.
Edith Masefield died in her house on June 15th, 2008. She was 86 years old. She left her house to Barry Martin, the construction superintendent who became her friend while simultaneously sandwiching her house between a Trader Joe's and an LA Fitness.
After she died, Barry began packing up her house, and he looked for things that would confirm Mrs. Masefield's crazy stories about her past. He never found anything about her escaping Dachau or caring for any war orphans. But he did find a Benny Goodman record with a written inscription that said, "To my cousin Edith, with love, Benny." After people found out that Edith Masefield had left her house to Barry Martin, there were some who called him an opportunist. Ultimately, it's hard for anyone other than Barry to know what his motivations were. But for what it's worth, I did talk to a couple of the home healthcare workers who took care of Mrs. Masefield before she died, and they both had a very high opinion of him. Said he was there every day when no one else was, and that he seemed to care deeply for Mrs. Masefield.
Barry eventually sold Edith Masefield's house to an investor who had various plans for it, none of which have materialized. And recently, the same guy asked Barry if he'd be interested in buying it back. He said no.
No, and if I did, Edith would probably haunt me for that. She told me to hold out until I got my price and then to, use the money to help get my kids through school.
The house is all boarded up now, and no one's sure what will happen to it, which is sad to some people. But Barry says Mrs. Masefield didn't care what happened to the house after she died, that she never really cared about the bigger story that the outside world had created about her. She had her own personal reasons for staying in her house, and they had nothing to do with that narrative.
But whatever her reasons were for doing it, she stood her ground, and she became a symbol whether she wanted to or not. There's even a tattoo shop in Seattle that does a special tattoo in honor of the legacy of Edith Masefield. It's a picture of her little house, and underneath it, the word steadfast. 99% Invisible was produced this week by Katie Mingle with Sam Greenspan, Avery Truffleman, and me, Roman Mars. We are a project of 91.7 local public radio KALW in San Francisco and produced out of the offices of ArcSign, an architecture firm in beautiful downtown Oakland, California.
What's that you playing?
You're listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts.
Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
Our opinion next turns to the problem of what the judicial role should be.
But I'm also aware of you know, jokes that I do, that I go, oh.
Comedians have their own set of informal rules about ownership of jokes. So these aren't laws, they're just norms of the community.
This is Life of the Law. I'm Nancy Mullane. If someone steals something from you, let's say your brand new flat screen TV, you'd probably go to the police. If they steal an idea from you, let's say an idea for a car that flies, you might go to court. But if you're a comedian and someone steals your best joke, the one that makes people laugh so hard they can't breathe, you might not go anywhere at all. This week on Life of the Law, who owns jokes? And why the law probably can help you if someone takes yours. Of course, this story starts with a joke about a boy who plays football and his dad who wants to see him win. Mary Adkins takes it from here.
And that man is still, every single game, that dad is right there. And he's in college getting better. He wins a Heisman Trophy. He ends up in the NFL. 5 years later, he ends up in the Super Bowl.
This is Carlos Mencia. You may know him from Mind of Mencia on Comedy Central back in 2008. He's pretty famous and pretty infamous. He's notorious in the comedy community for stealing jokes.
You know, if I'm doing a show at the Improv and Carlos Mencia walks in, I have no reason to believe that he would ever steal a joke from me or an idea from me, but if I saw him in the back of the room, that's going to be in my head the whole time I'm telling jokes.
This is Rory Scovel, a comic based in L.A.
Because if he decided to steal the joke, he would probably just get to have the joke and do his next special, and it would premiere on, you know, whatever network, Comedy Central or wherever, or just Netflix or a DVD that he sells, and he would make money off of a joke that I thought of. And
there are many examples of this actually happening. Remember that joke we just heard?
He shows him how to throw the bomb, how to throw the out, how to throw the hook, how to throw the corner.
Mencia did that on stage in 2006. Now, here's Bill Cosby on stage in 1983.
Teach him all that. Tackle me. Bam. And then soon he's bigger and he's stronger and he can hit you and you don't want him to hit you anymore. You say, all right, son, turn him loose on high school. And he's running up and down the field. High school touchdown.
Then that kid goes to college and that man is still, every single game, that dad is right there. And he's in college getting better. He wins a Heisman Trophy. He ends up in the NFL.
And 800,000 people in the stand. National TV, and he catches the ball and the camera's on him and you're looking and he says, hi, Mom.
Got anything to say to the camera? I love you, Mom.
Hearing this, it may seem pretty obvious what's going on. Mencia is stealing Cosby's joke. But when comedian Mark Maron confronted Mencia in a 2010 interview, Mencia said he doesn't steal, at least not intentionally.
And I am a sponge, so to speak. You know, I do remember, like, I don't write stuff down. But I'm also aware of you know, jokes that I do that I go, I don't know anybody specifically as much as I know that this
is out there.
Is not a, yeah.
If you're a comedian, it's part of your job to soak things in like a sponge. And everyone knows this. But where is the line between soaking something in like a sponge and straight up stealing?
Comedians have their own set of informal rules about ownership of jokes. So these aren't laws, they're just norms of the community.
Christopher Sprigman is a professor at NYU who focuses on copyright law. He says that in the world of comedy, people don't really use the law to prevent stealing. Instead, they self-police
about who owns jokes and how you come to own a joke and how you can sell a joke and how close you can come to somebody else's joke. I'm sorry. So these are informal rules of the community, and they're enforced through community action.
The comedy community is small. People go to each other's shows all the time. So if someone sees a comic doing someone else's bit, they'll say something. Word gets around, and usually that's enough. But what about the Carlos Mencias of the comedy world? What happens when talking it out isn't an option because the comic who's stealing from you is much more well-known, or even just because he insists it isn't happening? Turns out, the law really doesn't have an answer. To understand how we got here, we need to head back in time.
Hey, Grant, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay. So, will you tell me your favorite joke?
Let me see. I've got a bunch of favorites, but let me tell you this one. This is about Boudreaux.
This is my grandfather.
In South Louisiana?
When he was growing up in Louisiana in the 1940s, jokes were just kind of around. Boudreaux is a staple character.
Boudreaux, he do a lot of fish. He's always fishing. He's in his little P-Row one day out on the bayou there. He's fishing, and he looked down, and he is nearly out of bait. Man, he said, what am I going to do? I'm about out of bait. And he looked down there, and there come a snake swimming right along by his boat. And that snake's got a little frog in his mouth.
This is kind of a long joke, so I'll help my Gramps out here. Boudreaux sees the snake with the frog in his mouth, and he thinks, perfect, I'll use the frog for bait. So he grabs the snake and takes the frog, but then he's afraid the snake might bite him because he didn't think ahead. Luckily, he has some moonshine on him. He dribbles some in the snake's mouth. The snake looks happy, falls back into the water, and then comes back a few minutes later.
That snake didn't come back. He got two frogs in his mouth. That's about it.
My Gramps didn't write that joke. He just knows it. Law professor Christopher Sprigman says the first stand-up comedians were coming out of the same tradition as my grandfather. They just knew a lot of jokes.
If you think about stand-up comedy back in the 1940s and 1950s, it was based around the joke slinger.
Their hair was done by sticking her finger in the wall plug.
Right, so the stand-up comic who grew out of the vaudeville style of one-liners, joke after joke after joke.
Sprigman says no one owned these one-liners exactly. Comedians took each other's jokes all the time. There was even a name for it.
They referred to as the corn exchange. So they bought jokes, they traded jokes, they stole jokes.
The corn exchange wasn't anything formal. It was just a blanket term for all of it, including at least one instance of a comedian buying another's joke file after he died.
Think of Phyllis Diller, people like this who basically just told a whole bunch of jokes.
You know, the problem, these miniskirts, what in the world is happening with fashion? If skirts get any shorter, I'm going to have my legs fixed. They don't go all the way up.
Sprigman remembers going to the Smithsonian to research Phyllis Diller's joke file. He found tens of thousands of index cards with jokes scrawled on them. Some were original. Others, not so much.
She loved a comic called The Lockhorns, which was a comic about this couple that, you know, this married couple that was always at war with one another. And for years, she obsessively followed this comic strip, and she cut a lot of the panels out of the newspaper and pasted them onto index cards. They end up in the joke file.
And then on stage, when she talked about her fictional husband, Fang.
Of course, you know, my husband, Fang, he won't come into the kitchen at all because he's afraid of rats. Now and then he comes in at noon because he knows they eat out.
So in the 40s and 50s and early 60s, a lot of comedians are doing this. But in the late 60s, things start to change in comedy, in part because they're changing everywhere in the U.S. Over the 19th and 20th centuries, copyright law has gradually expanded, adding more and more protections to creative works, from music to movies to books to computer software. More people are caring all around about owning their work, and laws are following suit. But one genre gets left behind, comedy. And according to Sprigman, it comes down to something pretty simple. Who can lobby?
These are individual proprietors. There are several thousand of them traveling around the national comedy circuit.
and they operate at a very small scale, mm-hmm. right? So there's no powerful corporate player who owns enough of this business to actually lobby for changes to policy.
By the 80s, the transition is complete. The corn exchange is history. Now, even without the law behind them, comedians care about protecting their work. One way to do this is to make your stuff more personal, harder to steal.
So think of Sarah Silverman, right? So she has a very detailed comic persona. She's, you know, this smart but kind of obtuse moral monster.
Guess what, Martin Luther King? I had a fucking dream too.
If someone takes that joke, the name Sarah Silverman, if you know anything about her, goes off in your head.
I had a dream that I was in my living room. It wasn't my living room, but...
Today, you can find scores of lawsuits among artists in other genres. Photographers, musicians, writers. But there are virtually no copyright lawsuits between rival comics. No one has even sued Carlos Mencia, although there is a South Park episode where Kanye West kills Mencia over a joke.
Copyright protects original expression, but it doesn't protect ideas. And so often, if you wanted to avoid the copyright on a joke, you could just retell the joke a little bit differently, preserve the same idea that animates the punchline, but just change the expression.
Sprigman says you can find some lawsuits by comedians against people who take their jokes and make T-shirts, but not against other comedians who take their jokes and make money. Ironically, money is a big reason for that.
Copyright law is very expensive to use, so copyright's enforced through federal court litigation. That's very expensive. It's typically not worth it for a comic to file suit over a stolen joke, even if it's a really good joke.
In this realm outside the law, the gray area is pretty significant. Here's Rory Scovel again.
It's something that we call in comedy parallel thought, that something can be, two comics can have this exact same joke, not having stolen the premise or the punchline from each other at all. There's just some jokes that are a conclusion that you could easily come to.
This gray area is one reason why even if comedians did want to organize and push to be covered under copyright law, you'd basically have to overhaul the whole thing.
You'd have to trim back the distinction between ideas and expression. You'd have to protect ideas much more than mm-hmm. copyright law does now. You'd have to basically remake copyright in the image of comedians.
And Sprigman doesn't think that would be a good idea.
So there is a danger that if we propertize ideas or styles or trends, what we do is we basically impoverish the culture. We don't promote progress, which is what the Constitution says that copyright has to do. So I think, you know, remaking copyright law in the image of comedians would potentially do very little for comedians and potentially do a lot of harm to the rest of us.
Right. So for now, comedians are on their own, making us all laugh and keeping an eye on the back of the room.
This episode of Life of the Law was edited by Casey Miner, with sound direction and production by Caitlin Prest. Matthew Darr, Kyle Kaplan, and Todd McDonald composed our music. Life of the Law is a project of the Tide Center and is part of the Infinite Guest Network of podcasts from American Public Media. Take a minute to check out some of the other podcasts, such as You Must Remember This and Wits. Go to infiniteguest.org. Distribution of Life of the Law is also made possible by PRX, Public Radio Exchange. Life of the Law is funded by you, our listeners, and by the Open Society Foundations. For more on this story and others on the law in our lives, to subscribe to our podcast, or to make a donation to support production of future podcasts, visit lifeofthelaw.org. I'm Nancy Mullane.
You've been listening to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts. Learn more about these and other great radio podcasts at KALW.org.